from the Water and Environment Committee. Looks like we have a few members out on the road still. It might be a little slick out there, but we're going to go ahead and start our testimony. We have Stephanie Hallett. Could you come forward, please?
Madam Chair, do we not need to open as a subcommittee since we don't have a quorum?
Well, we're just taking testimony. We're just taking testimony.
I don't have a quorum. We could have a quorum of two if you could take a testimony.
We're just keeping up with the rules.
That's a rule of study. If you're just taking information, you can have two people.
We have one person.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I apologize that our committee is not all here at this moment, but we welcome you and we look forward to what you have to say.
Good morning, Chair Close and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stephanie Hallett, and I am the director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And I have a few brief remarks that I'd like to give to you this morning by way of overview, and then provide you opportunity to ask questions of me and get to know me a little bit, and then I can take back any issues you need some follow-up on as well. Very briefly, as I'm sure you know, the Department of Environmental Quality is responsible for providing leadership in protecting air and water and in cleaning up toxic spills and managing the proper disposal of hazardous and solid waste. We try to do our work locally. In 1993, as you may know, we decentralized our agency out of Portland. And so we now have a number of offices throughout the state. Those include Baker City, Bend, Coos Bay, Eugene, Hermiston, Klamath Falls, LeGrand, and throughout Oregon. We continue to have a headquarters in Portland, but we do pride ourselves in having a lot of folks out working close to the communities we serve. We run both state and federal environmental programs in the state. We are delegated by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to run federal programs on their behalf. Those include the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, which deals with hazardous waste, and other acts as well. Some of the state programs that we administer include our what we call our on-site sewage program, which is basically the septic tank program, which we administer jointly with counties. We also administer the Opportunity to Recycle Act, which is an Oregon law, the Groundwater Protection Act, which is also an Oregon law, and there are others as well. I'll talk just briefly about each individual program, air, water, and waste. Currently, we're very pleased that since 1980, when only 30% of Oregonians lived in areas that met the air quality standards, now we have 100% of our folks living in areas that meet the air quality standards, and we're very pleased about that. And the way we got there, basically, is through a permitting program. We require permitting of industrial sources. We also have, as I'm sure you know, in the metropolitan Portland area, a vehicle inspection program, which we also have in the Medford area. We work with some of our local partners on open burning. We also work with the Forest Service and others on slash burning, the Department of Ag on field burning. And we also had a few years ago some efforts to do a wood stove buyout program so we'd have more efficient wood stoves. So there are really multiple approaches to the attacking the problem, but we feel like we have done quite well. We also, the emerging issue probably in air is what we refer to as air toxics or hazardous air pollutants. We, in the year 2000, we worked on an emission inventory and doing some monitoring. We've set up an advisory committee to deal with that issue and to advise us on how to approach the issue of air toxics and making sure that we are doing all we can to minimize the pollution from air toxics from industry. Also, in addition to managing any of the chemicals produced which might pollute the air, we are responsible for what is called visibility of some of our pristine areas such as Crater Lake, and what attracts folks to Oregon obviously is to see the beautiful blue sky and the mountains and the trees, and we're responsible for protecting that as well. On the waste prevention and management side, we regulate, as I said, hazardous waste from the point of generation to the point of disposal, which would either be at the hazardous waste disposal facility in, near Arlington, or it would be out of state at other facilities. We also encourage pollution prevention. We have a program called the Toxics Use Reduction Program that helps industry develop plans for reducing their use of toxic chemicals, and we provide technical assistance in that program to help them do so. We also work on the solid waste side. We do regulate landfills, and we also are responsible for helping communities to recycle and reduce materials that go into the landfill. We do have permits and inspection of our landfills to make sure that groundwater is protected, surface water is protected, and there is no pollution going into the environment from those landfills. We also administer for the air program and the recycling program and also the water program as well, a pollution control tax credit program that I'm sure you will be hearing about as the session progresses. In our waste prevention and management program, we also have a program for that regulates underground storage tanks, and I'm sure you've heard about it over the years. And Representative Close, I did receive a letter from you yesterday requesting some information about one of the facilities, and I will be getting back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
We have basically implemented the underground storage tank program in terms of the requirements for tank owners to come into compliance or decommission their tanks, and we're now in the process of making sure that everyone has done so and taking care of cleaning up any spills from past practices in that program. There's also a heating oil tank program for primarily in residential areas where the department gets involved primarily when there are property transfers, and I personally can relate to this one because I'm going to have one from my mother's home when she passes away. I know there's a tank under that house somewhere, so I will learn how to use the heating oil tank myself, the heating oil tank program myself. We also do spills and environmental cleanup when our waste prevention and management efforts, sadly, are not as successful as we would like them to be, and there are, in fact, spills and cleanups that need to be done. We try and work with other agencies to prevent spills. I'm sure you've all heard about the new Carissa, which was probably the most visible effort that we got involved in. Most of the spills that we get involved in really are related to what happens on the highways and when tanker trucks turn over and there's an impact on water quality or an impact on the environment, and we do get involved in going out and assisting with those cleanups. We do maintain an inventory of cleanups that are going on where there's suspected releases throughout the state and industrial sites. Another large one I'm sure you've heard of is the Portland Harbor cleanup that now we're jointly involved in with the US EPA on that one. We had a lot of suggestions made to us last session about how to do better in our cleanup program, and we are very proud of the efforts we've taken this past interim to do that. There are several reports that will come to you in a variety of our programs, either through budget notes or other requirements, and so you will be able to read probably as much as you ever wanted to know about what we've done to improve this program as well as some of the other programs that we administer. But if you don't get something that you're interested in, let me know. Finally, our water quality program is our role. There are several agencies in state government that play a role in protecting water quality and water quantity in Oregon. We protect water quality. Except for drinking water, the Oregon Health Division is responsible for the drinking water program. The Water Resources Department regulates water quantity. Obviously, there is a relationship, and we work closely with those agencies. But basically, our role is to establish the water quality standards that protect our water for what we call beneficial uses, which could be drinking water, swimming, irrigation, fishing, whatever. We do have, as I'm sure you may have heard of, what is referred to as the 303D list, which refers to Section 303D of the Clean Water Act, by which we list streams that are failing to meet water quality standards. And we have about 14,000 river miles of streams listed currently on the 303D list, and we're working, obviously, to establish total maximum daily loads and I will be sure to fill you in on as much detail as you want on that. There is a lot we can provide, which may be more than you want for today's hearing. We've had a variety of clean water strategies over about the past 30 years. As in our air programs, we have permits that are for industrial sources. We also regulate municipalities, the discharges of sewage treatment plants, where they are discharging either to surface water or into lagoons or some other kind of system. We do regulate that. We also try and provide technical assistance. We have a 319 grant program, which refers to Section 319 of the Clean Water Act, for helping the watershed councils and communities and business as they do work on rivers protection and groundwater protection. We are, in fact, one of the major partners in the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. When you hear about TMDLs, which refers to total maximum daily loads, what that really means is when there's a river or stream, it is a process and calculation by which you determine basically how much pollution can that river or stream handle, which is referred to in the bureaucratic jargon as the assimilative capacity of the river or stream. So when you're setting a load allocation, you're basically determining whatever the pollutant might be that has been found in that stream. You're saying this is the amount that any particular source who's discharging to that stream can contribute to the overall pollution. And then hopefully you balance that all out so that the amount of pollution that is allowed to go in the river stream is not exceeding water quality standards. So it's, as you can imagine, it's a fairly complex process by which those calculations are made. But that's what setting total maximum daily loads is all about when you hear that term.
Can I ask a question?
You sure.
Is there an actual equation that you use and you fit variables into an equation?
Yes, except it's not quite that simple. There is extensive modeling that goes on. The basis is generally a broad model, and I would have to have folks who are much more educated on how that works come and talk to you about it. There is not just one size fits all. Basically, states are allowed to set their water quality standards because, as you can imagine, there's a lot of variation nationally in topography and types of streams. So we set the standards, and then we do, and we are, those are standards approved by the US EPA for our state, and then we do the modeling and the calculations that are required to see what is needed to meet those standards for Oregon.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
I
suppose my question would be, where do we get at the standards? You said we set the standards. Are these standards that we have some method of calculation, or are they arbitrary?
Representative Jensen, Madam Chair, there certainly is a method of calculation. The way the process works is there is required by law what is called a triennial review of standards. And there is, for example, there is a standards review committee that advisory committee that DEQ has established that is working on triennial review right now. And there are, I can't give you the names of all the participants today, but I can get those back to you. It's a broad-based advisory committee of citizens, technical folks who participate very deeply in the process whenever we set standards. And then our technical staff will do work, bring to that committee for review. There will be a whole entire public process, public participation in the setting of standards. And I'd be happy to get you some more information precisely on how that works or have someone come speak to you about it. But there is a group I know that's meeting very actively now on this cycle of triennial review.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Cruz.
First, I apologize for being late. I was on a conference call with my local chamber. And as we all know, local folks come first. But how do you apportion percentage of TMDLs to point and non-point?
Representative Cruz, Madam Chair, that is probably the most challenging question
that
we're facing
ask it.
Right now. particularly on the temperature standard, about which I'm sure you've heard a lot, and I will speak as educatedly as I can after my brief tenure here, and I'd be happy to have our water quality folks come back. But the doing it on the so-called point sources are the industrial or municipal dischargers. And you put a pollutant load in a permit, and it's pretty straightforward. You can say you're to that source, you're allowed to discharge this much. What Representative Cruz is referring to is on the so-called non-point sources, the agricultural runoff, the stormwater runoff in urban areas, forest practices, is figuring out what the contribution, relative contribution from those sources is in that overall load that I was talking to you about earlier. What we have been trying to do in the total maximum daily loads that we've worked on so far, which include the ones that are completed include the Tualatin and the Grand Ronde and the Umatilla, and there are others that are in the works. And just as an aside, we have a an end date to do all the TMDLs by 2007. But anyway, back to the question that was asked, is that we have part of the TMDL that is submitted to the US EPA for approval are the water quality management plans. And what is included in those is the non-point, the best management practices and the activities that will go on the non-point side that will meet water quality standards. So the water quality, you'll have some load allocations for point sources, and you'll have a water quality management plan that will include the Senate Bill 1010 plan, it will include forest practices and other elements like that, so that the TMDL that actually goes to EPA is a combination of load allocation numbers and also management practices to meet those TMDLs. And in terms of specific allocations on specific streams, I'd have to get back to you on that information. I don't know that today, but I'd be happy to do that.
Well, I guess part of my problem is I'm not comfortable with assurance that BMPs are actually all that's going to be required for non-point, and it puts non-point. We have always kind of assumed that we can do load shifting to non-point because it's undefinable, and so we give point source kind of a state of grace there by assuming shift And I've often wondered why we don't do, it would seem to me that if we did some comprehensive monitoring above and below point sources, all point source spots on a river system, I think we could be fairly accurate in assigning percentages, and I know we don't really do that probably the way we should, but I look at, for example, my river, the South Umpqua, which certainly has its share of problems, but then every municipality in Douglas County dumps into the South Umpqua River, and it's a low gradient, slow moving stream, so it kind of exacerbates the problem. And it would seem to me that if we were monitoring above and below Myrtle Creek, Riddle, Winston, Roseburg, things like that, we could really get an accurate picture of what percent of this load we should be attributing to point source. So,
was there a question there?
Well, maybe there's a question. The question would be, is this something that has been thought about as a way to get a more accurate picture of how we should actually distribute the TMDL responsibilities.
Representative Cruz and Madam Chair, I know that I can't give you the specifics on our monitoring program, but I can get back to you on that. I know there is a lot of monitoring that goes on, and I know that there is a lot of interest in monitoring in this body that will be discussed this session, and I'm sure we will have some extensive conversations. One thing I can tell you about the non-point is I think that US EPA wrestles with this as much as we do. I mean, nobody has a perfect answer yet, and all of these ideas, such as yours, are good ideas. And I think we're continually, as we work on each of these TMDLs, trying to figure out how to get that good data and how to get that good information to make informed decisions. So I do anticipate a lot of discussion about this. I'd like to get you some more specific information about the monitoring programs that are going on, and then perhaps at some future time have a more in-depth discussion about it with you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. I guess it would just be nice if we had a certainty that if ag and forest folks are doing best management practices to where they're minimizing impact, that there would be a certainty that that would be sufficient from their perspective, and that we won't at some point see more punitive measures. And I'm not sure that we're there yet.
I understand. Thank you.
Continue.
Okay. I just had a couple of other comments. I wanted to share with you our three strategic priorities. The first of these is dealing with what we call involving more Oregonians in what we do. And what that means to us, and what we really, when we started thinking about this, was in 93 when we decentralized. And we did that because it was clear that we were not connecting very well with the people we serve in Oregon. There's a lot of interest in environmental issues. They resonate with folks, and people care a lot about these issues. But they weren't necessarily connecting our agency as the agency in the state of Oregon that is really responsible for protecting the air, water, and land. And so we want to do a better job of connecting with Oregonians. Decentralization was one way we did it. We're also very active in the Governor's Community Solutions Team. We're one of the Community Solutions Team agencies. We've also made an effort with our field folks to do a better job of coordinating with and working with the other natural resource agency folks out in the field, so that we, when we're working with local governments or responding to issues in the communities, we respond in a cohesive manner. But we do have more work to do and more outreach. We have a lot of folks who come to us and want to do volunteer work. We're not really set to handle that. We don't know how to handle that very well. So there are opportunities there, I think, to connect more Oregonians to what we do. Secondly, as we were just discussing, one of our strategic priorities is protecting our and restoring our rivers and streams, as I've mentioned to you before, and there is still much to be done in that regard. And then thirdly, our third strategic priority is protecting health and the environment from toxic chemicals, as I mentioned earlier. You will probably hear during sessions some discussion about persistent bioaccumulative toxics. These are the, if you will, the cumulative effects of toxics in the environment. I believe the Oregon Environmental Council, for one, is going to have a legislative proposal with regard to mercury. They have formed a mercury task force. And so you may hear some more about that. We are also charged by the governor with addressing the issue of so-called PBTs through an executive order. So you will probably hear some more about that. And just finally, I would say that I'm sure it's no secret to you that as an environmental regulatory agency, we deal with a lot of complex issues. We don't make everyone happy, that's for sure. We try and do the best science work we can. We try and put an emphasis on public participation in our decision, our rulemaking processes and our permitting processes. We have a lot of advisory committees. We try to be inclusive rather than exclusive in our decision making. As a director, the message that I'm taking to my staff, basically I have three or four key themes, the first of which is excellence in everything we do. We're not always going to have folks agree with us, but I want people, when they have an interaction with our agency, to have a quality interaction with our agency, whether it's in a written document that you may receive, or a public meeting, or an inspection, or an enforcement action, that I expect our staff to listen and to be objective and to treat folks fairly and professionally in the work that we do. I also want to celebrate our science. We are a science-based agency. We have a lab. I think that we have undercapitalized a very useful resource for us. There's a lot of data. We've talked in cabinet among the natural resource agencies about how we can integrate the data better and make it more accessible to folks, and I would like us to take a leadership role in doing that. And I guess I would just stop there and take any questions that you might have.
I have a question. I'm interested in your decentralization. Can you tell me, just briefly, how many employees you have at each of your locations, how many locations there are, where they are, and how many employees?
Okay. In the entire department, there's about 750 people. And I haven't done a headcount for a while, but I would say about half of those are in the metropolitan Portland area in either our headquarters, our lab, or our vehicle inspection program, and the other half are distributed throughout the state in our regional offices. When we began our regionalization back in 93, we had maybe four field offices at that time, and I'd have to count on my fingers, but I think we have about 10 or 12 now. We have, when we decentralized initially, we had an office in Salem, we had an office in Medford, we had one in Pendleton, and we had one in Bend. Since then, we have added an office in Eugene, we've added an office in Coos Bay, we have one in Astoria. On the east side, we have Baker City, we have a fellow in Klamath Falls, we have a fellow in Ontario. These are not all large offices. We have one in Hermiston dealing with the Umatilla Chemical Weapons Facility. So that kind of gives you a flavor. I can get you the specifics of the exact numbers and where they are.
Typically, how many people would you have in a place like Astoria? Would that be a two-person
office? Two in Astoria, but it ranges. We'll have, I think we have about 25 in our Pendleton office. We have a couple of people in Baker City. I think we have about seven or eight in the Dalles. We have a person in Ontario. We have probably 30 people in Bend, probably 30 in Salem. The old regional offices we had are still our largest ones, although Eugene is pretty good size now as well.
Okay. So would it be fair to say that most of your employees are in the urban area? If you include Salem, Eugene, Portland.
I would say so. Before being the director, I was the administrator of the Eastern Region for DEQ, which was all of Eastern Oregon. And we had, I think when I started on decentralization, we had maybe between 12 and 20 folks on the east side of the mountains, and now we have about 75 throughout Eastern Oregon.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. A follow-up on yours and maybe something to ponder. It used to be in DEQ that if you went to the person in Roseburg, whether you were talking air quality, water quality, whatever, he was the person that you dealt with. Now, depending upon the issue you're dealing with, somebody in Medford or Eugene. You kind of have specialized your people to a degree, which may make some sense, but makes them a little harder to reach for folks when it used to be kind of a one-stop place where he could make the determination on an air issue or a water issue, and now we've got to have somebody come up, and that seems to me that maybe it's not quite the direction that things should have gone.
May I respond to that,
yeah.
Representative Cruz?
Yeah.
That's a very good observation, and to a certain extent was a trade-off. The way it used to work in our small regional offices, the field folks, in some cases, they could make decisions, but in a lot of the larger issues, they actually had to go back to Portland. So what we were trying to fix was to move accountability and decision-making out of Portland, but with that, as Representative Cruz correctly points out, we then moved the specialization out so that you now have in some of your larger regional offices, you'll have an air program, a water program, a waste program, or whatever, as opposed to just like maybe seven people who sort of did everything, but they might not have complete decision-making authority. So that the decision-making authority is now somewhere in the region as opposed to being in Portland, but it may not be right in that office. And we are, in fact, looking at whether or not there are some ways to kind of blend the two so we can keep that decision-making authority out there but also get answers a little quicker than having to go from Roseburg to Medford or wherever.
Well, and Madam Chair, there are levels here, too. There are some decisions that become fairly technical, but for somebody in Roseburg to have to wait for somebody in Medford to come up to make a decision as to whether we can burn a brush pile, to look at it and make a determination on impact on air quality. Those minor sort of things, I think we should be able to have a more immediate response, because I know the person in the Roseburg office used to do those and still can, and he has the expertise to make that level of decision. And I just think for a public service perspective, that's something that needs to be kind of looked at. And Madam Chair, my other question was having to do more with EPA and their moves over the last year or so to try to merge by definition point and non-point, so to where everything would basically be considered point source, and doing that by definition up any other way. Is that still on track, or has that disappeared, or do you know?
I'm going up, Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, I'm going up at the end of this month to meet with EPA up in Seattle. It'll be my first meeting since becoming the director. I have not heard anything about that recently, and it will be one of the things on my list to ask about. It seems to have disappeared off the radar screen.
Well, hopefully it has, but then you can never fully trust the feds.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'd like to say that I think the department is doing a lot of really fine work, in spite of the fact that you have the misfortune of being a regulatory agency, and in doing so, inevitably wind up with getting some bad press from some of the constituents. I was particularly happy and pleased a couple of years ago with the cleanup of the along the Umatilla River with the railroad car that turned over, and it was a really massive, potentially massive problem. And I thought the agency responded, quickly and very well. And I was especially pleased with your keeping me updated on what was going on. I found that to be very helpful. And I think your agency is one of the most helpful of all of the agencies in at least keeping me informed when there are issues going on, and certainly would encourage within your abilities to do so that you continue that. I do have a few questions, and Representative Cruz kind of started out with one which really probably is part was the last question I had, and that has to do, I suppose it's with the CAFO issue that has come up there, and there are a number of bills that are present on that, and that will be working their way through the system that I'm sure you're aware of and will be involved. The question is the MOA with the MOU, excuse me, with the Department of Agriculture, and there's two parts to the question, Madam Chair. The other part of that is that the Oregon statutes have not really apparently kept up with the EPA position on this, and I'm concerned at why we kind of get blindsided. Users out there get blindsided, with this, and have looked at some really fairly significant fines by the federal agency. If you could help me with those a little bit,
Representative Jensen, Madam Chair. First of all, for those of you who don't know, CAFOs are combined animal feeding operations. They're basically a regulatory function that is performed by the Oregon Department of Agriculture for feedlots, for lack of a better term. And the activity that Representative Jensen is referring to is an action that was taken at the end of last year by the Environmental Protection Agency coming into Northeast Oregon and levying some heavy fines on a category of combined animal feeding operation that was not being regulated by Oregon. The way the relationship works is that the U.S. EPA has delegated authority to DEQ for issuing permits where there are discharges to into the waters of the state. And the combined animal feeding operations were in, historically, they were an activity that were that was regulated by the Department of Environmental Quality. A couple of sessions ago, the legislature, it was actually a number of years ago, directed that the regulation of those operations more appropriately belonged to the Department of Agriculture. So a memorandum of agreement was developed between DEQ and the Oregon Department of Agriculture for Department of Ag, in fact, to regulate the so-called CAFO. So the authority came to DEQ from EPA, but then we wrote a memorandum of agreement with Department of Ag to do this on our behalf, as our legislature wished us to do, and legislation was enacted to allow that. Over time, and that went along, and everybody did their work, and things were going along fine. And then, as Representative Jensen pointed out, EPA took an action in Northeast Oregon that surprised us all. And as you may or may not know, there was a letter. I was in the governor's office at that time, and a letter was sent by the governor with the joint legislative leadership to EPA expressing concern about how this was handled and asking that EPA work in a more collaborative mode with the state to develop some legislation to fix the problem so that this particular size of operation could appropriately be regulated in Oregon, and we wouldn't have a need for EPA to come in again and take an enforcement action. That letter was sent. There has since been one or more dialogues. I think EPA came down and met with the legislative leadership, and there has been legislation drafted by the Department of Ag, I believe, that would fix the problem as far as we are concerned in terms of ODA's authority to administer this program. So we're on a path to fix our piece of it. Obviously, on my list, when I go up and speak with the acting administrator of EPA at the end of the month, is the process by which this happened. I mean, every couple of years, our agency goes into a negotiating process with EPA that's called a performance partnership agreement. In theory, we are supposed to be partners in administering these laws, and in my view at least, partnership does not include surprising your partner. So I intend to have a little conversation with them about the process by which they handled it. The merits of the argument notwithstanding, I don't think any of us here in Oregon were pleased about the process, about how that played out. Did that answer your question?
If I could follow a little more.
Okay. Then we need to move on. We have one other agency that will be.
All right. I'll try to shorten this up. The issue is that even after the legislation, the Department of Environmental Quality, if I understand correctly, will delegate to the Department of Agriculture. As a consequence, the Department of Agriculture will be an agent, and DEQ will still maintain the responsibility. Is that correct?
Basically, that's correct.
Okay. Two other questions. I'm going to forego the question on the or questions on the Hermiston Army Depot and the incineration of the gas there. We can get into lengthy discussions about that, I think. But I do have a concern. There was and this is kind of a specific issue, a couple of years ago, just after the last session, I think, there was a question came up about burning at the agricultural experiment stations in Hermiston specifically. And the department had in their rules at that time a classification of experiment stations under the Oregon State University Experiment Station, had in their rules that they were being treated as commercial enterprises as far as burning and burning permits were concerned. They were therefore specifically not included in the category that went with agriculture which has agricultural places have a slightly different standards that they operate with. We had a problem because much of the work and the scientific work that was being done at the Hermiston Experiment Station was potentially jeopardized by the wind which blows things in. And I made a request at least of DEQ at the time, and I've never heard the later follow-up that their administrative rules be changed so that agricultural experiment stations be classified as farms as far as this particular component is concerned. Can you help me with whether that has or has not taken place?
Yes, I can, Representative Jensen. Madam Chair, first of all, I apologize for nobody getting back to you. My understanding is there were rules just recently adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission, and I believe that problem was solved in those rules. But I will double-check that for you.
Thank you very much, because if that hasn't been, it just strikes me that these are, though they don't sell the product, they are farms. I mean, sort of thing.
Stephanie, I have a question I wanted to ask while you're here. And I'm not on the Ways and Means Sub for Natural Resources, so I haven't looked at your budget specifically, but I'm told that the greatest percentage of your budget is from fees and also from fines. Can you tell me what percentage is from fees and from fines? I would like you to respond about, I have a concern that the incentive is, if your money comes from fines, then the incentive is fines. And I'd like you to comment on that system and if you have any ideas about what might be a better system, or if that is a good system.
Representative Close, first of all, just one point of clarification. None of our budget comes from fines. All of the fines that are levied by the Department of Environmental Quality go into the general fund. So we do not get any of that revenue except indirectly, as it may come through general fund. Fees are another matter. As you correctly point out, I think it's like 64% at some point. I have to check the numbers again of our entire budget. Are from fees, and if you look at when we are in Ways and Means, we'll have a lot of graphs to show this, and I can provide them to you. Over time, I've been with the department 12 years, and we've just seen the percentage of our budget that's funded by fees increasing over time. I think at the time I came, the shares between general, federal, and fees were roughly equal in terms of funding of our budget. And now, as I said, it's like 60-some percent fees and then 15, 18-something general fund and then the rest is federal. So it's dramatically changed. And, yes, you're correct. There will be a lot of discussion in Ways and Means about proposed fee increases by the department, primarily in air quality and water quality. There's some others as well.
Now, what is your opinion on that?
Well, my opinion, quite candidly, I have said in some of my opening remarks as a director and to various groups, I would love nothing more than to figure out in my tenure as director some kind of stable funding for the department. I don't like the system for a variety of reasons. One is fee payers. I have no illusions about this. Fee payers are maxed out. I mean, it's just... it's a very, very hard situation, and I empathize with how they're feeling about it. Secondly, I think one might ask for a regulatory agency the legitimate question about the majority of your budget being funded by those you regulate. I don't know that there's any option to do otherwise, but I think it's a question that one might discuss. And then thirdly, in terms of an investment of resources in what we do as an agency, we've never really kept track of the amount of time we have to spend as an agency dealing with negotiating fee schedules, coming here and speaking with you folks about those issues, figuring out how to pay for the work we do rather than doing the work itself. In my view, it's not what one would want us to focus our energies on, but there's no choice given the situation. So that's my opinion.
I just have one more question concerning the lab that you were talking about. Is that something that the committee, if we could arrange it, could tour? We could see the process for the testing?
Absolutely.
field trips.
Yay!
Cookies and Kool-Aid.
We're up for field trips.
We have to run.
We will be in. Are there any other questions for Ms. Kellett? Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Okay, we call forth Dick Benner, who is with the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Director.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Dick Benner. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. Am I about the right distance from the microphone, or is that
That's it.
It's okay?
Would you say you hit the right place? The microphone?
The tape.
The microphone is fine.
Okay. What I would do with you this morning is to give you a brief history and overview of the Oregon Land Use Program and follow this outline that I've handed out to you. With me this morning in the back of the room, I believe, is Bob Rindy, who is our legislative coordinator. Some of you probably know him from earlier sessions, but those of you who are new and don't know him, I'm sure you'll get a chance to meet him. I would point out to you on the second page of the outline, up toward the top, is our website address. If you were to visit the website, you'll see much more information, obviously, than I'm able to give you this morning, including, for example, a copy of the statewide planning goals, our biennial report, which would give you a little bit more detail about many of our programs. So that's there handy for you in case you want to visit the website. Madam Chair, let me ask you, how much time would you like me to take and how much time would you like me to leave for questions?
We have allowed a half hour for presentation and then probably 10 minutes for questions. And we have one more presenter at about 20 to 10.
I'll try to keep it to under half an hour.
Okay.
Starting with the history, and this is probably familiar to some of you, the land use program, at least the one that you'll see on the books today, is about 26 years old, starting with Senate Bill 100 and Senate Bill 101 in 1973. But actually, there was a deeper root for the program in Senate Bill 10 in 1969. That legislation passed and required local governments to have comprehensive plans, and it established goals, I guess you could call them, but they were required elements that a comprehensive plan had to address. That legislation did not set up an agency. It said that if a local government did not adopt a comprehensive plan by the date specified in the legislation, the governor's office would take over planning for that jurisdiction. That was not a successful effort. And one of the reasons Senate Bill 100 came along was to address the inadequacies of Senate Bill 10. Senate Bill 100, most of you are familiar with that. Very briefly, it established, it repeated the requirement in Senate Bill 10 that cities and counties have comprehensive plans. It said that the plans must be consistent with a set of statewide planning goals, and it established an agency, the Land Conservation and Development Commission, and a department in order to administer the program. One of the most important things that Senate Bill 100 said to the new commission is to establish statewide planning goals. One reason I mentioned Senate Bill 10 is when you pick up a tabloid of the statewide planning goals and you wonder where the subjects came from, and they range from citizen involvement to urbanization and a list, you can find the root of many of the goals in Senate Bill 10. That's where the commission first looked for the statewide planning goals. So the commission got work underway in 1974. It conducted hearings around the state, and in January 1, 1975, adopted 14 statewide planning goals. Shortly after the first 14 goals, the commission adopted one additional goal on the Willamette Greenway. That was in 1975, later. And then It wound up its goal-making work 1 year later, late in 1976, when it took over the work from the Oregon Coastal Conservation and Development Commission and adopted four goals for the coast: estuaries, beaches and dunes, shorelands, and ocean resources. So those comprise the 19 statewide planning goals. That was done by the end of 1976. A period of years from 76 to 1984, these were the years in which cities and counties were either adopting comprehensive plans in the first instance or revising the comprehensive plans that they already had in order to comply with the statewide planning goals. You would probably find it interesting if you read through the original 1973 version of Senate Bill 100 that cities and counties were to finish this work in 1 year. It didn't happen that way. The last comprehensive plans were not acknowledged really until 1984. So it took much more time than anybody anticipated. But it was largely done by the end of 1984. There are three other dates I note here. I'm giving you a very brief history, of course. The three things I wanted to note here in 81, 85, and 93 are three particular pieces of legislation that were among the most significant in the history following the adoption of Senate Bill 100. I want to emphasize, though, that every legislative session since 1973 has amended the program one or more ways. So it's always had very close legislative attention, and there have always been bills and successful bills amending the program. The three that I would highlight for you: in 1981, there was a significant piece of legislation passed called the Post-Acknowledgement Law. In Senate Bill 100, there was no attention given to what happens after a plan is approved by the agency. In other words, what happens to it over time? As you know, communities change, their needs change, and communities want to change their comprehensive plans to address changing conditions. There was nothing in Senate Bill 100 that talked about how that might happen. And then, as you probably also know, many of you have been on city councils or county commissions, there are plan amendments that happen on a regular basis because of new information, for example. And what happens to a plan that has been approved as complying with the statewide planning goals if it's amended? So that's what the 1981 law did. And that's where periodic review came from, where a community periodically takes a look at its plan and the information that underlies it and decides whether it needs to do something different. And I'll get into that in a little more detail in a moment. In 1985, to the present, this is I guess you would call it the post-acknowledgement period after all the plans were approved. The basic effort of the agency, of the department, and to a large extent local governments on land use has been periodic review, making amendments and refinements to their comprehensive plans. There have been many revisions to the statutes and to our rules that I would describe as refinements, revisions, improvements, and whatever. But that's really what it's been about since plans were first acknowledged. The second piece of legislation that I would draw your attention to was in 1993. That was House Bill 3661. It made significant changes to the law on dwellings on resource lands, farm and forest, and land divisions in those two places. And if you're interested in how that happened and what forces were acting on that, I'd be happy to address those and questions. Point number two here: what are the elements of a successful land use program?
Yeah, Dick, before you move away from that, at what point did the commission become a department?
Representative Cruz, in Senate Bill 100, both parts of the agency — I use the word agency to describe both the commission and the department. So Senate Bill 100 established both the commission and the department, and the commission, like other commissions, is laypersons appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, policy setting, and the department carries out the policy.
Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair,
one other question I have. When you're talking about the comprehensive plans, who individually wrote these plans? I mean, who...
Counties.
Is it, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is, was it each county wrote a plan? Was that what happened?
Representative Mona Sanderson, every city and county has one. There are, depending upon the recent and most recent incorporations, I think there are 276, it may be 277 cities and counties, 36 counties and the rest are cities. They, each one of them has a comprehensive plan.
Thank you.
And one of the first goal is citizen involvement, and it prescribes, it sets forth a requirement that every city and county have a citizen involvement program, and they use that program when they develop their comprehensive plan. So I guess you could say that each plan was written by, ultimately by the elected officials of the city or county. They were ultimately responsible for it, but they all had planning commissions and they had a citizen involvement process, and a lot of people got their fingers into what's actually in the plan. I've listed here what I think are the principal elements that comprise the Oregon program, starting with policy. You have given direction to the Oregon Planning Program, and this goes back a number of years, of course, in two principal statutes. The one is Senate Bill 100. That is now at 197, Chapter 197. And if you pick up that legislation and look at 005 to 0010, you'll see what was on the minds of legislators when they enacted Senate Bill 100. A lot of it, you'll see, has to do with concern about coordination among the many units of local government that they felt at the time, legislators did, that there was not good coordination among cities, counties, special districts in particular, and that was adversely affecting growth and development in the state in the minds of legislators at that time. If you look at Chapter 215-243, that comes out of Senate Bill 101. Not many people remember that there were five bills, really, that that assembled the Oregon Planning Program. We tend to talk only about Senate Bill 100, but that was one of five bills that were seen as part of a package. And Senate Bill 101, and I make reference to it here at 215-243, was actually the place where the most important substantive policy was placed by the legislature. That's where you see the legislature talk about the importance of protecting farmland and other natural resources, the importance of being careful about the urbanization process to make sure that it was done efficiently, to try to keep the cost of public services down. You find that policy here rather than in Senate Bill 100. So that's a really important element of the program. And when you read the statewide planning goals and look at amendments to these statutes over the years, you can always go back to these policy statements to get a sense for the roots of the program.
Could I ask real quickly, that ORF 197, do you know the year that that was put in statute?
1973, initially. Yeah, it's been amended heavily since then, but that's when it was first enacted. A commission and department, we've talked about that a little bit. That's the agency, and the commission is made up of seven people. The formula for where these folks come from and such as that has been changed a number of times over the years, most recently in 1997. So now there are districts around the state, and a commissioner comes from each of the districts. So you can look at that and get a sense for what the statutory makeup of the commission is. The department implements the policies of the commission and the legislature. The department itself has 63 full-time equivalent positions authorized, has a budget of about $16 million, and I can give you more detail about that a little bit later. The statewide planning goals, I mentioned that Senate Bill 173 directed the commission to establish statewide planning goals, and the source of many of them was Senate Bill 10 from 1969. City and county comprehensive plans, one very important feature of this program is that it is not implemented directly. It is rather implemented through city and county comprehensive plans. So, if the legislature says do something about manufactured housing, remove obstacles to them, that will often be done through a comprehensive plan. If my commission says protect riparian areas or aggregate sites, It will say that in a rule, but it will actually be implemented in a county comprehensive plan, in this instance, in an ordinance of some kind, zoning ordinance probably. State agency coordination, often overlooked, very important. One of the important aspects of it that local government supported back in 1973. What the law says is not only local governments, but also state agencies have to make sure that their programs and activities comply with the statewide planning goals in the first instance. And then importantly for local governments in the second instance, once a comprehensive plan is approved, then a state agency program and activity has to comply with the city or county comprehensive plan. So this gives local governments a measure of control over state agency activities. Periodic review and plan amendments. Periodic review is the process by which cities and counties bring their plans up to date. What I mean by that is really two things. If you pass a new law that you want to have implemented through a comprehensive plan, or if my commission changes a goal, and that's to be implemented through a comprehensive plan, that generally happens at periodic review. Periodic review, depending upon the size of the city or county, happens every 5 to 15 years. Major new piece of legislation last session, Senate Bill 543, changed the periodic review process with a number of objectives in mind, and I can get into that if you'd like to pursue it in questions. But this is a very important process that cities and counties go through on a regular basis. The other reason they make changes, of course, is something happens to the community that they didn't anticipate. For example, if a correctional facility is located 3 miles out of town, that's going to change much of the information they relied upon in terms of population growth and housing needs. So they need to make revisions to the plan. One thing that you should understand is, even though periodic review is only periodic, every 5 to 15 years, cities and counties can amend their plans anytime they choose. Each year we look at many thousands of plan amendments that cities and counties do, again to keep up with the times and changing information. So they don't have to wait to periodic review to make these plan amendments. Enforcement, there are two principal enforcement provisions in Senate Bill 100 for the agency. One, if a particular decision by a local government in the view of the commission or the department does not comply with the statewide planning goals, then the agency can seek a review of that decision at the Land Use Board of Appeals. The Land Use Board of Appeals, by the way, is completely separate from our agency. It is a separate agency, and it was established in 1979 with the object of sending land use decisions to a single tribunal statewide rather than to all the circuit courts of the state to get some sort of uniformity and much faster decision-making. So Land Use Board of Appeals has been around since 1979. The second enforcement provision in Senate Bill 100 talks about situations in which a local government makes a series of decisions that violate its comprehensive plan or its ordinances or the statewide planning goals. In that instance, the commission holds a hearing and can direct the local government to take certain action, most likely to stop doing what it was doing. And over the years, there have been, I believe, about 25, 26 enforcement orders used with local government. It's about one a year. We haven't had enforcement under this mechanism for a couple of years. And I should go back to the Land Use Board of Appeals. On average, our department files somewhere between 15 and 20 appeals at LUBA each year. The caseload at LUBA is about 250, 260 cases a year, just to give you a sense for that. And to put it in a larger perspective, there are probably somewhere between 10 and 15,000 land use decisions made in a year, ranging from a significant change to a comprehensive plan to a conditional use permit. So that helps you get a sense for what's happening out there.
Mr. Benner, could you just add... Is there a cost for LUBA? What is for the general citizen to go for LUBA, what is it going to cost them?
Madam Chair, to file at the Land Use Board of Appeals, I believe it is currently $325, and that's set by the legislature. LUBA does not have authority to set that by itself.
And they need counsel, is that correct?
No, they don't. They are not required to have counsel, and I can't tell you what percentage of appeals are filed by individuals who do not come with attorneys. But LUBA has made an effort to keep its procedures relatively simple, particularly if you contrast it with what you have to go through with a writ or something in the circuit court. It's pretty easy on relative terms. It's not easy, but if you hear from LUBA, I'm sure they can tell you how often people come in without attorneys.
Thank you.
Grants and technical assistance. One of the important things that Senate Bill 100 added that was not present in Senate Bill 10 is a grant program. It's one thing for the state to direct every city and county to have a comprehensive plan that complies with state goals, but many local governments, very small, don't have planning staffs or maybe one person whose time is taken up at the desk. So we have always had a significant grants program for local governments. Initially, it was to help them adopt plans. Now they serve for periodic review or special projects that local governments do. And our local government grants program, this biennium is just over $3 million. It's been relatively stable for 4 or 5 bienniums, growing only at the pace of inflation. So it's been pretty stable. Technical assistance. Much of the time of the people who work at the department is spent with cities and counties around the state to help them revise their zoning ordinances or their subdivision ordinances. Most of the technical assistance is given to the smaller counties and the smaller cities because the larger cities have larger planning staffs. The last thing I would say about the program I would emphasize is its flexibility. And let me illustrate that just by giving you a sweeping historical view of how things changed from when it got started in 75. Initially, the commission in 1975, after it adopted the goals, thought the most important thing was to get urban growth boundaries in place and to protect farmland outside urban growth boundaries. In 1978-79, however, the cost of housing started to rise fairly significantly. And as a result of pressure from home builders and Thousand Friends of Oregon, the commission started to give attention to goal number 10, the housing goal, and made some significant changes in how local governments responded to housing when the times called for that. Then you'll probably remember shortly after that, Oregon slipped into recession, and it was a rather deep recession for Oregon. And although the commission had a Goal 9 economy from 1975, it hadn't given as much attention to that. Well, it began to give much closer attention to it in the early 1980s in order to help local governments make sure that their plans and ordinances removed obstacles where they existed to economic development. And then later on, as the years went by, as the need arose, the legislature, the commission in combination would make adjustments to the program in order to respond to changing needs. Probably the most recent one is the Salmon Plan, the Oregon Plan. What contribution can the Land Use Planning Program make? What contribution can city and county comprehensive plans make to protect fish runs? And we overhauled Goal 5, a portion of which is aimed at wildlife habitat, in order to try to do a part of the Oregon Plan. Number 3, basic policies. I'm just making an effort here to summarize the statewide planning goals, but if you're looking for the basic policies, you would find them in the statewide planning goals, but I should caution you that also you should look at the statutes, because there's a lot of policy that's been added over the years to the statutes as well. If I could summarize the statewide planning goals into an overall policy framework, it would be, as I've tried to condense it right here, containing urban development within urban growth boundaries, encouraging development within those urban growth boundaries. That's goals 9, 10, housing, economic development, public facilities and services, for example. In other words, removing obstacles to development inside urban growth boundaries. And when you get outside urban growth boundaries, the emphasis is on protecting the natural resource base, the land base for commercial agriculture and forestry. And this is very much a condensation of it. I don't mean to shortchange the other statewide planning goals. There are goals on the coast. There's citizen involvement. So there's more to it. But I just wanted to give you a quick picture of the overall framework. There are some special programs attached to the land use program that you might not ordinarily know about. In 1972, Congress passed the Coastal Zone Management Act and said, invited states to have coastal programs. Any state that adopted one that complied with federal legislation got two things. One, access to federal grants to run the program, and in our case, to pass money through to local governments on the coast in order to implement the program. And number two, a measure of control over the activities of federal agencies on the coast. One thing you'll probably hear about while you're in the legislature is what control does the state government have over the activities of federal agencies in Oregon? It's a big question because the federal government owns 52% of the state. What you will learn if you haven't already is not much. But an exception to this is on the coast, because in the Coastal Zone Management legislation, the federal government voluntarily gave up some of its control to states that had approved coastal programs. The Oregon Coastal Program was approved in 77, and it is implemented in the very same way as the rest of the land use program. Cities and counties have comprehensive plans, but they have four additional goals to pay attention to: the estuary goal, the shorelands goal, beaches and dunes, and ocean resources. And to give you an example of the measure of control that might come should the state exercise it, is over oil and gas activities by the federal government off the coast. As you know, the territorial sea, which belongs to the state of Oregon, goes out 3 miles, but the state exercises some measure of control through its coastal program for the bottom and the sea itself out further through the Coastal Zone Management Program. So it's important. It also gives local governments, once a coastal city or county has a plan approved, gives local governments a measure of control over federal agencies. The most recent instance of this, very important last year, an undersea cable was making its way across the Pacific to the Oregon coast. I think the landfall was around Bandon, and commercial fishers were quite concerned because every time there is an undersea cable laid, there are limitations on bottom fishing in the vicinity of the cable in order to protect it against breakage. And our ocean resources goal, one of the 19 statewide planning goals, gives priority to renewable resources. And so in a series of negotiations, I played a very small part in it. The commercial fishers were able to rely upon the Oregon Planning Program to get some, to extract some concessions from the companies involved with laying the cables in order to protect fishing rights. So it's an important element of the coastal program that not many people know about. The Transportation and Growth Management Program, since 1992, our agency has worked closely with the Oregon Department of Transportation to work on combining land use planning and transportation planning. The theory here is that the state makes very large investments in its state transportation infrastructure, and if land use planning doesn't do a good job, poor land use planning can undermine the effectiveness of the state transportation system. On the flip side, if a transportation facility is poorly planned, it can wreak havoc on the livability of a community. And as you know, state highways are often the main street of many of our cities and towns. And if the emphasis from the transportation side on moving goods and people through town fast does not give adequate consideration to the concerns of cities and counties, a transportation facility can adversely affect the community's livability. So we're working with ODOT to try to get land use and transportation to work together.
Mr. Banner, I don't want to leave lots of time for questioning, so could you sort of summarize in the next 5 minutes or the rest of your speech?
Yes. The floodplain management program, we do that for the Federal Emergency Management Administration. So if you're looking for it, you would find it in our agency. Our regional problem solving, I will skip over that. I've listed here the four or five major issues. These shift over time, of course, but expansion of urban growth boundaries is of large concern in parts of the state, not in other parts of the state. How we deal with protecting salmon habitat in urban areas is a major issue not resolved. We've had a regular conflict between aggregate extraction from agricultural land and protection of agricultural land, and I can get into that in greater detail if you like. I mentioned a little bit about land use and transportation, and then local resources for planning is an issue you'll probably hear about from cities and counties. They've found it increasingly difficult to find resources within their own budgets to do long-range planning. So with that, I'll answer any further questions you might have.
Okay, as chair, I'm going to jump in first.
Prerogative.
We deal with where the rubber meets the road with our constituents, and the question that comes to us is this person, and I want you to address the $80,000 income guideline. The citizen comes to us, they say, you know, I'm a small farmer, I've got 5 acres, I make $25,000 a year off that land, I'll never make $80,000 off it, and that land, you know, that rule favors the large producer, but it doesn't help somebody like me. What do you say to a person like that?
As a result of legislation from last session, there was direction to us to take a look at the $80,000 test, and we completed our report. It's available to you. You could find it at the website, and I can certainly make copies, hard copies, if you prefer that available to you. And that would give you much more detail than I'll give you in this brief answer. It tells you about the derivation of the test by the commission, what forces led to it, what the data indicate about it since it's been in effect since mid-1994, et cetera. But let me just give you a quick picture. There are 16 million acres around the state that are in one kind of farm zone or another. Very much of that is rangeland. Mostly on the east side of the state, a little bit on the south side of the state. That's probably 10 million to 11 million out of the 16. The $80,000 test applies only to what is called high-value farmland. And high-value farmland is defined in this legislation I was pointing to in 1993, House Bill 3661. Our estimate is that out of the 16 million acres, about 4.5 million is high-value farmland, and it tends to be the state's cropland. So when you hear about the $80,000 test, it doesn't apply everywhere. It applies to that $4.5 million acres of high-value farmland. On the balance of the land, the rest of the 16, there are other tests, and they are three. But I won't get into those because you're interested in the $80,000 test. What the commission was concerned about, and this goes back to the beginning of the 90s, was data coming in from annual reports, which you require of counties to the department, of the decisions that they make in farm zones, ranging from land divisions, farm dwellings, wineries, model airplane facilities, all the things that are authorized in a farm zone. What the commission was looking at is a pace of dwelling approval that greatly exceeded any indication that there were new farms forming at that pace. So the 89 legislature directed the agency to do a study of what was happening with dwellings in farm zones. And that study was completed in 1990. I'd be happy to share it with you. It showed that It, what it looked at was what was happening on the tracts of land on which new dwellings, farm dwellings, had been approved over a period of about 3 years. And it found that about, I'm going to have to try to remember the statistics, but a large percentage, well over 50%, were not producing any farm income at all. And about 75% were producing less than $2,500 a year. That persuaded the commission that its efforts to have a test which would ensure that new farm dwellings in farm zones were actually being approved for farmers and not from people who were simply wanting to settle and establish a home site out in farm zones. It went through an awful lot of work over the next three to four years, trying to find a test which did that and was actually implementable at the local level. One interesting phenomenon I would draw your attention to is look at the number of Land Use Board of appeals that this department filed over farm dwellings, say going back 10 years as compared to today. The number has dramatically decreased because a combination of legislative direction and commission amendments to the Goldfish Rule have gotten the test now so that it is clear and objective, and it does not really give rise to litigation. There's
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yeah.
Based on what you're saying, and maybe you could tell me, I'm told that 90% of the private land in Oregon is zoned either EFU or forest use. Is that true?
That sounds close, yes.
And it's based on soil sample?
I mentioned 16 million acres in farm zones. If you pick up Goal 3, that's the agricultural lands goal, it has a definition of agricultural land in it, and it is derived from the natural resources, the federal agency's soil capability classification system, class 1 through 8 soils. So if you read Goal 3, it will tell you which of those soils fall within the definition of agricultural land. If land does fall within the definition and it's outside an urban growth boundary and it isn't in a rural residential area, it will either be in a farm zone or a forest zone. There are approximately 9 million acres in forest zones. So if you add the two together, it's about 25 million acres. That's about, you remember how much is federal. So I would say 90 is pretty close. We've got those numbers.
Do you agree then that makes it very difficult if 90% of the land is off limits for home building, even in eastern Oregon? That really limits where people can go and have homes.
Well, Representative Close, let me correct a misconception that a lot of people have. You mentioned that it's off limits to home building. That is very far from facts. The first thing you should understand is that farm dwellings are only one class of dwellings that are authorized in farm zones. There are four or five others. Probably the leading track for home site zones are non-farm dwellings. Non-farm dwellings have been authorized by statute since, I believe, 1973 in Senate Bill 101. And if you, I can give you all of these numbers because they are reported to us on an annual basis. In fact, they are in our biennial report. Your statute requires us to report them to you in the biennial report. You would see that in any single year, give or take 100 here and there, about 1,000 new dwellings are authorized in farm zones around the state. A number slightly smaller than that are authorized in forest zones each year around the state. And that number has been relatively steady over the years. The makeup of them among the classes of dwellings that are authorized has changed. What we have seen, what was accomplished by a combination of House Bill 3661 in 1993 and the Commission's rule on farm dwellings, is the mix of dwellings changed. The overall number coming into farm zones each year is steady. But we've seen the number of farm dwellings diminish, and we've seen the number of non-farm dwellings increase. And that actually was the expectation of the legislature when it enacted 3661 in 1993. But I should give you the numbers so you can track that. We display it graphically, and in fact, if you want to pursue that, we'd be happy to come in and talk about just that subject and bring the information with us.
I'd appreciate that. I'd appreciate like a one-page sheet of most asked questions about land use that we could have for our constituents that would help them through what's a very difficult process for them and for us. Other questions?
Madam Chair? Mr. Benner, I was just wondering, just to make sure I get this straight, on the $80,000 issue, the goal here was to slow down the acceleration of what some people call hobby farms and that sort of thing, where they weren't really farming.
That's a way of saying it, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was, and the idea overall is to preserve farmland in Oregon, one of the goals of the land use system. And I was just wondering then, how did you get to $80,000?
In 1994, we put together an advisory committee task force composed of farmers, farmer organizations, county planning people, others, and asked them. The charge from the commission to them was recommend to us a test that distinguishes between farmers looking for dwellings that they need to run their farms and people who just want to move into the countryside. We also want a test that cities and counties can implement. We want a test that is not terribly intrusive. We want a test that is clear and objective as much as possible so that it does not spawn litigation. And that was very much on the commission's mind because the principal test in effect that time generated a huge volume of litigation over whether a new dwelling met the test or not. So what that committee looked at was the makeup of commercial agriculture in Oregon, and it defined commercial agriculture as those farms generating at least $10,000 of gross income, not net income, but gross income in a year. And the reason it went with that test is with the help of the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the Farm Bureau, it looked at which farms actually generate the income that supports the agricultural industry, implement dealerships, processing, and all of that. And county by county, we have all these numbers, by the way. You can see that the farms that generate at least $10,000 in gross income, these are the farms that produce about 90%, 95% of all farm income in the state. Those farms statewide, that is commercial farms, generate well over $200,000 a year. So there was on average, it's an average number, there was a thought to establishing that as the test for a new farm dwelling. The committee did not want to set the test that high. The commission didn't either, because so much of Oregon agriculture is part-time. They felt that pegging it at 80 was about the right place, because it was enough income that, generally speaking, the person who's just moving into the countryside, all he or she wants to do is move into the countryside, is not going to generate that kind of income. But it's sufficiently below what the average commercial farm does that it allows for people who are in agriculture as a part-time endeavor. And there's more to it than I can tell you about briefly here. I will, if you would like, I can distribute the report coming from Senate Bill 454 last session, and that'll give you a larger picture of it.
Is that, how thick is that?
It's it's not too bad. I think it's
right, sure.
Okay. We can deal
with it. We can handle it.
Madam Chair.
One other question, just so that I have a perspective of when you say 16 million acres as part of a farm zone, how many acres are we talking about total in Oregon then? 16 is compared to what? 16 out of how many acres? Is that like a tenth, a twentieth?
I think it's 92 million.
92 million.
But I'd have to go to the Blue Book.
Okay.
I used to know, but I haven't read the Blue Book recently.
That would be helpful to know the percentage.
Yeah.
If you could compile that for us, and we could have that information. Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple things. Dick, I don't know if there are things to answer or just comments, but when you talk about transportation and growth management, it seems to, and I know that this is a relatively new, I was concerned when you entered into this agreement with ODOT, because what we're seeing now in a lot of areas is where we have commercial zones that ODOT is basically excluding by denying access, and so it seems to me like we have dual land use systems that don't seem to be connected. And we've experienced a fair amount of that in Douglas County, where we've got commercial property, we have historic access, and ODOT comes in and says, oops, we don't want that many entrances onto this road. And so, you know, especially in our part of the state where we're trying to foster some economic development, ODOT seems to be working against us, and it seems to me they have authorities that should be solely vested in you. So what kind of oversight do you have over that part of the process, and can you override a decision of ODOT as far as access on an issue like that?
Representative Cruz, we do not have any authority over access. You probably know that, I don't know when they finished, but ODOT, the Oregon Transportation Commission, adopted access management rules for the first time ever. I believe it was last year, but it mm-hmm. might have been late 99. Those access management rules, and you probably ought to hear from ODOT about them rather than me, but they were intended to regularize the process of access management until the rules were adopted. They were not applied uniformly. There was an awful lot of discretion given to each of the five regions to deal with access. Also, an effort to draw all of the interests involved or interested in access to get as close to a consensus as possible about how ODOT ought to manage access to state highways. And I don't know this firsthand, but I hear that people are generally fairly pleased with the new rules, and I would imagine that some of the difficulties that you've experienced in your district may well have been addressed and resolved in those rules. But the best way for you to learn that is to hear from them.
Well, not real recently, but certainly. I guess part of my problem here is that, you know, the counties and cities have gone through great pains to develop the comprehensive plan, and they have, you have a lot of oversight over modifications of the plan, and they develop commercial zones, residential zones inside urban growth boundaries or wherever, and then for some other agency to come in and arbitrarily alter something that's been in plan for a long time simply by saying, oops, we don't want, you know, that's fine, you have that commercial property, but your access is a half mile down the road. You know, those sort of things really bother me, and I guess my problem is having too many folks at the head of the line making decisions that affect land use planning when we have an agency that's supposed to be totally in charge of that. So another question. First off, let me say that from my perspective, there's a huge difference between Class 1 and Class 8 soils. And to box them all together, I'm not sure is real accurate. But the issue that I think we're probably going to explore a lot is expansion of urban growth boundaries. And from my perspective, that has been, you know, our land use system could have been described as chaos before Senate Bill 100, and since then I would call it organized chaos. And because basically we do concentric things, and are we looking at any way that we can have huge set-asides? I mean, for example, when was the last time a new community was developed or a new incorporated town was created in the state of Oregon? You know, how in this desire to keep growth in a contained area and to protect prime farmland, do we set up a system where we can say 5,000 acres of great farmland right here next to the urban growth boundary, but 15 miles over there we've got another 10,000 acres that is not so good and it'd be a great place for community, but we can't seem to get there? Comments?
A couple. Representative Cruz, I don't think there's been an incorporation in the state in some time. There were two on the ballot in November, Lapine and Merlin. Both of them were turned down by their voters. Our department, of course, we did not take sides in that, but we had, I skipped over regional problem solving here. Both of those communities were in locations where we had made significant regional problem solving grants to resolve some fairly significant growth management problem you probably know about. You're fairly close to Merlin. And in our view, incorporation would have been the right part of the solution in both of those instances. And to some extent, we regret that the voters chose not to incorporate, because we think that that would have been good solutions. In Lapine, in particular, the solution that was developed by the local government there to a problem, a very large problem, south of Sun River all the way down to the Klamath County line, would have been to establish Lapine, which is already a growth center, a small growth center, but to make it a larger growth center to accommodate the transfer of development from along the floodplain of the Little Deschutes and the Deschutes Rivers. Mm-hmm. Into that growth center. We thought that was a very, very sound decision. Merlin, same thing. You probably know that the most important tracts of land available for industrial development in the county are not in the urban growth boundary of Grants Pass. It's up around Merlin. Merlin is not incorporated and has trouble attracting services. And the regional problem-solving effort there pointed to incorporation as one answer. The other answer, which we supported as well, was incorporation of that entire area in the Grants Pass urban growth boundary so that it would be easier to provide services to it. I don't know where they're going to go, but they voted incorporation down.
Excuse me. I'm going to have to interrupt because we have one more person to testify. And I want to give him lots of time. So.
If I can make just one very short comment, and because I knew where Dick was going with
this. Well, I'd like to give him the last word.
Okay, but I guess I think this speaks to a problem that, you know, the people did vote down incorporation, which logistically makes a lot of sense, but I think there's an inherent fear of everything that comes with that, and I think that's an issue that probably should be addressed.
Quick comment?
I think he's correct.
Mr. Benner, thank you for coming. This has been fascinating, and I hate to cut it off because I've learned a great deal, and I appreciate mm-hmm. you coming, and I hope that we'll be able to have you come again.
And we'll put this information together for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Former Representative Welch.
We discussed last night we'd delay this until next Wednesday when you can.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were ready to present today. Oh, thank you. No. Oh, I'm sorry.
That was a good cutoff point, anyway. It really was.
Well, if there are no further comments, does the committee have further concerns or comments they would like to make on either of these two agency presentations?
Yes, Madam Chair. In my area up in Clackamas County, we have a number of unincorporated areas that would like to perhaps become incorporated, but the process for becoming incorporated is very difficult. And I'd like to hear from a panel of folks, like maybe Art Schlatt from county government, someone from city government, really explain what the problems are with incorporation from local viewpoint. And I would imagine that other regions around the state have similar problems.
An excellent idea. I think that we will direct Megan to pursue that and arrange that if we can arrange it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the you know, the discussion today was mostly on the high value farmland. I would like to have the department, I don't think we have time to get into this today, but I'd like to have the department to talk about this issue from the very lowest value and the stages that go along, and maybe they could put together kind of one-page guidelines for us or half-page guidelines for us on each one of however many stages they have in this, so that we could see that. Yeah.
Mr. Benner, did you note that? Excuse me. Representative Jensen would like to have a discussion
about the other land.
You mean secondary lands, Representative? Is that what you're talking about?
Pardon me?
You mean secondary lands?
Yes.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah.
Does that include?
That's that part of the state that's out in that uncharted wilderness, you know, east of the Cascades.
And south of Cottage Grove.
And south of Cottage Grove.
If I may, Representative Close, one bill that passed last session directed the department to establish a rural lands database and appropriated $200,000 to help establish it. What we can do, I'm not sure when we'll be ready to do this because it's a the work doesn't really wind up until the end of the biennium, but we may be in a position to show you what's in the database. I know part of your question is, where is this land that is not, I was talking about high-value farmland, and you're asking about the rest. We've got some of that mapped now as a result of this database, and we'll have more of it mapped as the biennium goes along. So how about if I keep in touch with you, I'll inquire about what's available now and check with your administrator, Ms. Plow, and maybe we can bring it in, and that would be a good way of getting into a discussion about those lands.
Okay. Would that be acceptable? Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. I'd just like to tell you that we will not be meeting Friday, so that the chair can attend the presidential inauguration.
Say hi for me.
Hopefully there will not be too many demonstrators and we can actually get through the crowd. We're looking forward to a good experience. We will be trying to meet Monday. Representative, I will not be back, but Representative Morgan will chair that committee Monday if we can arrange those speakers, so be looking for an agenda. When do you think, Megan, that could be posted?
By tomorrow. Huh?
By tomorrow. All right. Sorry. It's still up in the air, but we will let you know ASAP on that. Are there any other concerns for the committee? Okay. We are adjourned.
Have fun.